Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm sitting here with Rob O'Hearn. And we're across from Chloe Hooper, who's come in to talk about a new book, The Arsonist. Welcome, Chloe.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. Now, you've had some enormous success with Tall Man, which was quite some time ago, but it just continues to be on people's lists of great Australian reads. And you've been researching this book for, which is The Arsonist, for how long now?
Probably, I took an interest in the story immediately after Brendan Sokolock's arrest on the suspicion of setting fires on Black Saturday. And I then really about 5 years ago started to look more seriously at the story.
What was it about what you saw that triggered this interest?
Well, I think that Black Saturday in February 2009 was just such a devastating day, and it seemed incomprehensible to me that somebody would deliberately light a fire on a day of 46 degree temperatures where a firestorm was created. And I wanted to know who becomes an arsonist and why.
Yeah. And is it got to do with any initial fear? Because when you start the arsonist, you quickly go into the horrors of the fire and what it's like for somebody to experience such a thing, the ones who survived and also the ones who didn't. Is it something to try and make you come to grips with that? Is understanding the arsonists themselves a way of putting that horror behind you? Or what was the, it seems such a terrifying thing to do, to sort of step into this and look into it even further. For someone like, when thinking about myself going into it, I probably would have turned away.
I suppose without sort of seeing the sort of horror of what the fire can do, what an arsonist can do, you don't really wrap your head sort of fully around the extent of the problem. And, it will be an ongoing problem because more and more people live on the outskirts of the bush, and we're living in this warming climate. So unfortunately, this is a story that will keep on going. On Black Saturday, there were hundreds of fires, and there were five fires in which people lost lives. Three of those were initially were believed to have been deliberately lit. So, in a way, if you turn away from the psychology of what actually leads somebody to sort of set that first flame, you don't really understand the phenomena of the fire. And it is horrendous, but I think at the end also people are endlessly fascinating. What does motivate somebody to do that? To me there was always something pretty compelling that I wanted to follow through. Of course, the details of Brendan Sokolock's life were quite sad once I uncovered them. But I think true crime in Australia often turns out to be, those stories are often ones of dysfunction and disadvantage.
There's a lot about the area, too, that's gone into in the book about the people in Churchill and Morwell. And there's a sense when you talk about while the investigation's going on, they just also arrested somebody for incestual relations with their daughter. And in the area, there's a kind of gothic thing to the small town areas and people being allowed to be somewhat out of the ordinary and strange and do strange things, and that being sort of tolerated. And that's a kind of interesting crime story in itself, how people can be noticed as weird, but people just sort of accept that.
Well, I think, we're all endlessly weird, really, although we try very hard to disguise it. But, I think certainly in small towns, you know. There is all, you know, often somebody like Brendan. Yeah. And Brendan was arrested about 5 days after Black Saturday, and he struck the arson squad detectives who arrested him as being an odd character, and they weren't sure whether or not he was actually sort of putting on his impairment throughout their police interview. He was diagnosed 2.5 years after having been arrested with a intellectual disability and also as being on the autism spectrum. So Brendan is not an uncommon character in the law, and he's not an uncommon character in small towns. I mean, you know, there's often somebody who seems, you know, more odd than us. Yeah. And I guess he was tolerated in his community.
His behavior didn't seem like, when you look at him going driving around and picking up
scrap metal
and stuff, that doesn't seem too, I mean, it's not what I would choose to do on a weekend, but yeah, it's not too weird. And then, like, working as a groundsman, he was able to sort of do that and do the course. And there are certain striking bits about his behaviour, like his kind of little obsessions.
Yes.
And his trolling of people.
Yeah, the public wouldn't see it. Like, some of the internet stuff would be, you wouldn't have a clue.
No.
But, you know, the day-to-day kind of behaviour.
Yes.
And he was delivering the papers.
He was. I mean, he was also, you know, he was also watching children's television, 39-year-old man, and, you know, tinkering in his shed, listening to sort of, you know, Bob the Builder serials. So
a lot of that, I mean, you have to be a close neighbour to have any clue.
I suppose that's right.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we think of these things, like, he was so obvious. It doesn't, like, and even the when you describe the police, you know, they're kind of going, it's a bit weird, but is it that weird? Yeah.
Well, that's right. I mean, and I think the thing is that a lot of the guys that the police run around after in that part of the world where there are very high crime statistics, which are connected to, I guess, the unemployment in the region and, you know, other indicators of disadvantage that are there. He didn't seem like a completely uncommon type initially.
Mm. It is interesting the way in which you write this, because there's the journalist side of you, then there's the novelist side of you that comes in. You can feel it creeping in there. It's like, because you're so interested in the different perspectives, and there's no, I mean, a good novelist will hide that as best they can, and to try and...
A good journalist, you mean?
Or a good novelist will also do as well. Good novelist will kind of try and hide that. The perspective of the novel will sort of tend towards a certain... Yeah. But the better the novelist, the more perspectives and the more right everyone seems to be in their coming together. Journalist is kind of the rule. You have to be objective.
Yeah.
But that can sometimes stop you from crossing that tiny little bit of a line, which is there, which the novelist will quite happily cross, and which I hunger for in a lot of nonfiction. You know, I want people to give me just that little bit more insight into what's going on in their head. So I actually enjoyed your novelist insight into the minds of you know, the lawyers, the police, the bystanders, the witnesses. You know, there's a little extra bit which I think a novelist can bring to this kind of writing. Do you have that? Is there a novelist journalist part of you that you sort of go, hey dude, this is not for you. This is my journalist side doing this. Don't interrupt here. We have to keep to the facts. Thanks.
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, I think now the different reflexes, you know, I can't tell when one's being switched on and when the other one is. But thank you for noticing that. I think that as I grow older, I want more emotional depth in a story like this. I'm sort of looking for, you know, how people are affected, as sort of, you know, as deeply as I can, and how do I mean, in a way, this is a sort of all legal stories become these kind of warring narratives. And on the one hand, the arson squad detectives felt that they'd arrested a cunning serial firelighter, and the legal aid lawyers who I then went on to meet, who defended Brendan Sokolock, believed that they were representing a bewildered, hapless, naive almost. And so sort of, you know, marrying those two stories was, and trying to work out those perspectives, as you put it. I mean, I feel like the more perspectives you have, it's almost a way of circling closer to the truth, which you can't ever actually, why he did this, you know, none of us will really ever know, but you get, maybe you can get as close as is possible.
Yeah, because I mean, I've read a few true crime things where I've gone, the giveaway is in they're not painting a 3D image of a particular person. They're going, okay, I don't really like that perspective. But in this one, I don't get that. I get the full perspective, and you're forced as a reader to be sitting there like a jury member, listening to all the facts and getting really impassioned different points of view to try and put it all together. And it's difficult. I mean, so often when you see reportage on cases, it just looks so black and white from outside. And then if you're sitting in that case, it's so murky.
It's really interesting you say that. One of the legal aid barristers pointed me towards an article called Where Does All the Anger Go? It was basically about juries. And it's about, you know, the fury that, you know, we feel towards an arsonist collectively. You know, initially this guy was painted as a monster by the press. And I mean, it's very easy to hold on to that point of view because the effects of the fire were just so devastating. 11 people lost their lives, but hundreds of people lost their homes. And the ripples of this just go on and on. And, the strange thing about a fire, of course, is that the intention behind that first flame doesn't necessarily match the result. But, you know, that the fury that you might feel by the time it reaches a courtroom and the jury are sitting there making the decision about him, actually, they see the tragedy of the situation, but they also see the sadness of this person's life. So, I mean, I think you can actually look at the true horror of the fire, as you mentioned, you know, is there in the beginning of the book, while also being able to at the same time kind of have a view of this man which has some dimension to it.
Because that also then rolls back onto us. You know, we're responsible for that man in this weird way. Like at the moment, there's a ton of, you know, of movements within law to try and, you know, toughen law and blah,
yes, blah, yes,
this stuff. And we're as a society where if there is tons of poverty and if people aren't getting the education or the services they require, then people are going to fall out of it and not be assisted in the ways in which they might be. And so there's kind of in a societal culpability of and it is a tough one because people just don't want it.
No.
They don't want to have that associated with them and their choices and who they vote for
absolutely.
And how they see life and their theories about you know, self-responsibility and the choices and chances you have in life.
I think tough on crime when you realise that actually such a high percentage of those who are moving through the justice system actually have intellectual disabilities makes a bit of a mockery of, you know, of sort of politicians, you know, calling for us to be tough on crime.
Yeah.
You know, I think in the end, though, is a fiend born or created? Yeah. And I don't know the answer to that either, you know, of we are responsible and yet there's another element there too.
I think you'd be a really boring writer if you knew the answer.
I don't know any answers, yeah.
Because that's part of the great pleasure of reading such a book like this. You can see that you're actually exploring it in your own mind. You're having a debate and you're positing these things all around. And that takes us through the debate, which then brings us into questions we don't want to have asked of us.
You know? Sorry.
Yeah, and so but it's, I think it's really important that these books are written, that people do... are dragged through this and do see it. Because at the beginning of the book, you're like, let's get that guy. Great. and you're stomping off, and then suddenly you get the lawyer bit, and you're like, whoa, mm. what?
Yeah.
Whole different perspective comes in.
And it's striking too how many suspected pyromaniacs there are out there
yes.
that are sort of known, but mm. we can't quite do anything about them. And people in the town kind of think, well, it could be that person.
Yes.
And it's like, but what can we do? It's just part of, it's an ongoing threat that
yeah.
society has no answer for.
Yes.
But you can't, it's not, like some people would think, yeah, well, there's a threat, let's just isolate it and contain it. But you can't. There's, it's not even something you can truly identify as a threat.
Well, yeah, I was stunned to learn that in the aftermath of this fire, the arson squad had the names of 30 different fire setters in that region yeah. alone. And although Brendan was somebody who wasn't on their books at all, so who else wasn't
yeah.
and isn't? Yeah. And this... You know, an area like the Latrobe Valley where it's isolated, it's on the fringe of bushland, and there's a lot of unemployment. You know, it's very difficult to profile for arsonists, but it's easier to profile communities where fire setting becomes a sort of, you know, a form, unfortunately, of self-expression almost.
Yeah, and you even talk about the people who may not set the fires but who come to watch when the fires
But we all do that in a way. Yeah, I mean, it's a form of community and entertainment. In the old days it was. Yeah. I mean, you know, we gather around fires for warmth and conversation yeah. and it's sort of deeply wired in us.
Oh, now I'm suspicious of myself. I sit in front of a fireplace at home. Damn it. I love staring into the fire.
Yes, well, you know, I'm glad that we got you here today. It's an intervention.
the other things that you point out in here is, and it seems bizarre that in the internet age that there aren't databases that link up.
That I think that there now are.
Yeah, because that just, I read that and I went, what?
Yeah. Yeah, in 2009 in Victoria, that's right, it was a sort of ad hoc system, and different sort of jurisdictions or areas sort of knew who had spreadsheets, and they knew who suspected arsonists were or people who had, you know, previously offended, but no, they
didn't collect.
There wasn't like a database. Yeah. Now there is such a thing.
Yeah. Now that you've spent this long on this book, is there a novel bubbling away in you? Is there another something else that sparked your interest that you're chasing down as the journalist side of you? What's going on within the creative side?
I'd have a couple of ideas that I'm working on, and actually that's creatively, it's a really nice thing to see one book cross the road, I guess, and get to start on a new set of obsessions.
Mm.
Yeah.
And can you give us any, like, which road are you taking? Is there a hint that you're going to take in the nonfiction or the fiction road?
I'm both.
Both?
Both.
Ah,
both.
Right.
Yes. But, I'm enjoying, stretching both muscle.
Well, we both really found this book fascinating. I think a lot of Australians will. There's an obsession with fire, and as you said, the climate change that is going to make things more difficult. Also, the management of the land is going to make things more difficult. You know, we've turned away from old management techniques, and which causes more likelihood. But I think it's going to strike a chord as this summer rolls along. This sort of gives you that feeling of the drought and everything. But there is that on the edge of everyone's horizon.
I think we think about summer slightly differently now.
Mm.
And that probably isn't going to go away.
Yeah, yeah. And also, you know, if matters start looking at our neighbours...
Yes, well, that's always useful to do
yeah,
too.
And those people that stare into the fire.
Yeah, well, I have to say though, it's got some of the best descriptive writing I've read on bushfire ever. It's just amazing. I grew up in country areas and I have an understanding of bushfires, not anything in as intense as Black Saturday, but wow, that's your writing really just captures it so well.
Oh, well, that's lovely of you.
Just saying that, have you gone out there like the weather chasers and gone stood near a bushfire to?
No, I'm a scaredy cat. but you know, it's very kind of you to say that. But I did have extraordinary source material to work from. I mean, a lot of those. The most powerful descriptions really are other people's words that I've strung together. Yeah. So, I can't really kind of, take too much credit there, but, I do hope it gives a sense of what it would be like to, live through a fire. And I think that's something, certainly in Southern Australia where, you know, the memory of it's still so poignant and powerful. I think people now are less likely to decide, you know, in a gung-ho way that they're going to stay and protect their houses.
Mm.
Yes.
Just before we go, has anyone read it who's been through this? Are you going to wait until it's out in publication?
No.
To find out what people
The person who I became close to in the writing of this book is an amazing woman called Shirley Gibson, and Shirley lost two children in the fire. And I don't think in her circumstances I could have read this from cover to cover, but she has. And she's a very incredibly gracious person, and I hope she's not just being polite when she says that actually for her this was cathartic to read.
A state that with so many fires and so many memories, have something like this and it does do that. It's a wonderful thing
for her. I don't presume for okay. Others. Yeah,
Chloe, thank you so much for coming in. It's a fascinating book, and there's so much more to talk about. But we want other people to read it, and we don't want to talk it to death. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
And you can get hold of Chloe's book, The Arsonist, at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.